It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Here's a story told by a master storyteller named Andrew Stanton on the TED stage.
A tourist is backpacking through the highlands of Scotland, and he stops at a pub to get a drink, and the only people in there is a bartender and an old man nursing a beer, and he orders a pint, and they sit in silence for a while, and suddenly the old man turns to him and goes, "You see this bar?
See this bar?
I built this bar with my bare hands.
Found the finest wood in the county. Gave it more love and care than my own child. But do they call me MacGregor the Bar Builder? No.
No." Points out the window. "You see that stone wall out there?
I built that stone wall with my bare hands. Found every stone, placed them just so through the rain and the cold. But do they call me MacGregor the Stone Wall Builder? No.
No." Points out the other window. "You see that pier on the lake out there?
Pier on the lake out there. I built that pier with my bare hands, drove the pilings against the tide of the sand, plank by plank, but do they call me MacGregor the Pier Builder? No.
No.
But you one goat."
Storytelling is joke telling. It's knowing your punchline, your ending, knowing that everything you're saying from the first sentence to the last is leading to a singular goal, and ideally confirming some truth that deepens our understandings of who we are as human beings. We all love stories. We're born for them. Stories affirm who we are. We all want affirmations that our lives have meaning. And nothing does a greater affirmation than when we connect through stories. It can cross the barriers of time, past, present, and future, and allow us to experience the similarities between ourselves and through others, real and imagined.
And there's a good chance Andrew Stanton has taken you to that place as well. Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc., Wall-E, A Bug's Life, all the Toy Story movies, Andrew Stanton either wrote or co-wrote all of them.
You do a pretty good Scottish accent.
Except for anybody that's Scottish, we'll tell you I don't.
Our show today is about people like Andrew Stanton, about what they do and why stories, the ideas and the conflicts and the truths we find in them, why they shape almost everything we believe. And we'll hear a lot more from Andrew Stanton later in the hour, but first to another story, one told by the novelist Tracy Chevalier. And this one begins in an art gallery.
When I go into a gallery, first of all, I go quite fast. And I look at everything, and I pinpoint the ones that make me slow down for some reason or other. I don't even know why they make me slow down, but something pulls me like a magnet. And I just go to that painting. And then the second thing I do is I stand in front of that painting and I tell myself a story about it.
Tracy wrote an entire book about one single painting, the most famous painting by the Dutch artist Vermeer, Girl with a Pearl Earring. Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yeah, I first saw a copy of the painting in my sister's apartment when I was 19. She was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I walked into the apartment and I saw a poster of the painting on the wall and I just stood in front of it and stared. Wherever you are in the room, her eyes seem to follow you. Her mouth is really glistening and her lips are slightly apart and she's just staring at us, and she's also, most importantly, wearing a big pearl earring in her ear. It's so simple. There's nothing in the background, just her. And there's a look almost like she's just turned her head and is looking over her shoulder at us. Vermeer painted her skin so luminously. What kept me looking at the painting was the expression on her face, which is really difficult to read. Sometimes she looks happy, and sometimes she looks terribly sad, like something very sad has happened to her.
What was it about her, though? How did you know there was a story with her?
Well, you know, I didn't. For a long time, I didn't know there was a story about her. I had the copy of the painting this poster hanging up everywhere I went for, I think, 16 years before one day I was lying in bed and I was looking at it. And then suddenly it popped into my head, I wonder what the painter did to her to make her look like that. It was the first time I actually thought, that's a portrait not of a person, but it's actually a portrait of a relationship. Because the way she's looking has something to do with him and how she feels about him. And that was what made me think, there must be a story there to their relationship, and I want to find out what it is. So here's how I came up with the story. First of all, I thought, I've got to get her into the house. How does Vermeer know her? Well, there have been suggestions that she is his 12-year-old daughter. And I thought, no, it's a very intimate look, but it's not a look a daughter gives her father. For one thing, in Dutch painting of the time, if a woman's mouth was open, it was indicating sexual availability. It would have been inappropriate for Vermeer to paint his daughter like that. So it's not his daughter, but it's somebody close to him, physically close to him. Well, who else would be in the house? A servant, a lovely servant. So she's in the house. How do we get her into the studio? We don't know very much about Vermeer, but the little bits that we do know, one thing we know is that he married a Catholic woman. They lived with her mother in a house where he had his own room, where he his studio. He also had 11 children. It would have been a chaotic, noisy household. And if you've seen Vermeer's paintings before, you know that they're incredibly calm and quiet. How does a painter paint such calm, quiet paintings with 11 kids around? Well, he compartmentalizes his life. He gets to the studio and he says, nobody comes in here, not the wife, not the kids. Okay, the maid can come in and clean. She's in the studio. He's got her in the studio, they're together, and he decides to paint her. He has her wear very plain clothes. Now, most of the women in Vermeer's other paintings wore velvet, silk, for very sumptuous materials. This is very plain. The only thing that isn't plain is her pearl earring. Now, if she's a servant, there is no way she could afford a pair of pearl earrings. Whose are they? We happen to know there's a list of Caterina, the wife's, clothes. Amongst them, a yellow coat with white fur, a yellow and black bodice. And you see these clothes on lots of other paintings, different women in the paintings. So clearly her clothes were lent to various different women. So we've got all the elements for our story. She's in the studio with him for a long time. These paintings took a long time to make. They would have spent time alone all that time. She's wearing his wife's pearl earring. She's gorgeous. She obviously loves him. She's conflicted. And does the wife know? Maybe not. And if she doesn't, well, that's the story.
That's amazing. I mean, you got all of that from a single static image, and it's basically a made-up story. This is fiction.
I know. It's I still laugh that it's such a simple painting, and yet I did base the story on what's in the painting, and also the little tiny bits of biographical detail that we know about Vermeer. And that's what I based it all on, which is very little, but yet it is quite a lot. I mean, I think maybe what it is we have dramatic lives. Oh, they might not seem dramatic to the outside. But to us, it's those little daily incidents of life that are dramatic. And if you put a frame around it, an actual painting frame, or if you put a frame that is a novel around small incidents, they suddenly become bigger because you focus. And anybody can focus on things that don't seem to mean much, and suddenly they become much bigger and much more important than you ever imagined.
Do you ever think, like, what if this becomes his story? Like, what if people confuse fiction and fact?
I think a little bit of that has happened, which I feel flattered by, but I'm a little terrified by too. And I'm really glad that I wrote the book before it occurred to me that that would ever happen.
I guess I'm wondering, you know, I mean, there's amazing power in the story you shared. Like, people wanted to hear that story. They didn't care that it wasn't true.
Yeah, they didn't care it wasn't true, but I think they've kind of made it true. I think that a lot of people have a hard time looking at that painting without thinking of that story. And maybe novels that work are the ones that, you know, you suspend disbelief. And I think people have suspended disbelief in a kind of long-term sort of way. The suspension is going to go on all their lives while they look at those paintings.
What does a good story have to have?
What does a good story have to have? I suppose it has to have a journey. I like to have a character who has to change. Most of us still look for that template because it's what human beings do. I think that we tell stories to make sense of the world, to make sense of our lives, to make them mean something to us and to our descendants. And it's a very natural thing that humans have been doing for thousands of years. In that way, I think we are quite conservative in that we do like literally a beginning, a middle, an end. A beginning, which is normal. The middle, which is the change and challenge. And the end, which is the new normal.
Do you still go and visit her? Do you go see that painting?
Yeah. It lives in The Hague at the Mauritshuis Museum. And I find it, in fact, whenever I see her, I find it very hard to leave the room. Because I think I keep looking at the painting like, even though I've written a whole story about it, which supposedly explains this look of sort of torment on her face, I'm still not sure that's actually what's happened. I always about to leave the room and then I go back to look at her and I think, are you finally going to tell me what you're thinking? And she never does. I liken it to a song that ends on the second to last chord rather than giving you that resolution that you're craving. It just never gives it to you. And that's what makes the painting so very powerful because it gives us such a huge gap there that we fill it in. And so we really become part of the painting ourselves.
Novelist Tracy Chevalier. She wrote the book Girl with a Pearl Earring. You can hear her full TED Talk at ted.npr.org. On the show today, Framing the Story, the things we find out about ourselves when we hear them. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and it's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, Framing the Story. And well, what if you had to tell someone's story? A story that was already written, and you had to tell it in an instant.
I'm endlessly amazed after 26 years, still to this day. One of the first questions is, do you actually read the book? And I can't imagine not doing that.
Ship Kid.
That would be me.
Designs book covers. Maybe you've read some of them.
Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, Haruki Murakami, 1Q84, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, David Sedaris, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, David Rakoff, Fraud, Oliver Sacks, The Mind's Eye, and all of his backlist. Elmore Leonard, all of his backlist.
And Ship Kid's job with each book, to tell the story even before you open it up. In his TED Talk, Chip walks out on stage wearing a black blazer with gold trim and black eyeglasses. And he stands there, motionless, like a statue. And then he does a full body wriggle.
Hi.
When he says hello.
I did that for two reasons. First of all, I wanted to give you a good visual first impression. But the main reason I did it is that that's what happens to me when I'm forced to wear a Lady Gaga skanky mic. I'm used to a stationary mic. It's the sensible shoe of public address.
Okay, so for Chip Kidd, the idea that a first impression matters, that it can tell a story, it's not a theory, it's his life's work.
Now, first day of my graphic design training at Penn State University, the teacher, Lanny Simese, came into the room and he drew a picture of an apple on the blackboard and wrote the word apple underneath. And he said, okay, lesson one, listen up. And he covered up the picture and he said, you either say this, and then he covered up the word, or you show this.
And then he took his hand away, and so then you had the picture of the apple, and you had the word apple underneath, and he said, but you don't
do this. Because this is treating your audience like a moron. And they deserve better.
It seems like you did that for the cover of Jurassic Park, which is a T-Rex skeleton in silhouette, but you can tell that it's like coming alive. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, we had tried many different things. The problem was, you know, how do we make this look like what it is, which is a book about dinosaurs unlike any other book you've ever read about them?
Someone is re-engineering dinosaurs by extracting their DNA from prehistoric amber. Genius! Now, luckily for me, I live and work in New York City, where there are plenty of dinosaurs. So, I went to the Museum of Natural History, and I checked out the bones, and I went to the gift shop.
So we're going to start with what we know, which is the dinosaur bones, the teeth and the ribs, and then evolve them, so to speak, so that it now it's something more than the bones, but it's not there yet. It's growing. And it's going to get there. And then when it does, you know, you won't be able to control it.
I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea where I was going. But at some point, I stopped. When to keep going would seem like I was going too far. And what I ended up with was a graphic representation of us seeing this animal coming into being. We are in the middle of the process.
A book cover designer is making a piece of art, a piece of design that's very much in service to another piece of art. And that other piece of art is the more important one. If all the stars align, as I think they did with Jurassic Park, you get this great fusion of, like, you can't think about the book or the movie without envisioning that image.
What's your favorite story you ever told in a cover?
Probably the New Testament.
What was the story?
What's the story?
I mean, we know the story, but what was the story you told in your cover?
This was 1996, and basically it was trying to make it real. And I used a photograph of a dead man, his face, by Andre Serrano. He was granted access to photograph corpses as they were coming into a morgue in New York City. And he photographed this tight close-up of this man's face, and he was laying on his side. So you just see one of his eyes and 3 or 4 inches in all directions around it, and it's very bloodied. I mean, I don't know what happened to this person, but the eye is half open. And so you get this distillation of horror, but it there's also a serenity to it that's very odd, because it's completely juxtaposed to what you're actually looking at, and the idea that something could be dead and alive at the same time is sort of suggested.
I have devoted the past 25 years of my life to designing books. What I really wanted was to be a graphic designer at one of the big design firms in New York City. But upon arrival there in the fall of 1986, I found that the only thing I was offered was to be assistant to the art director at Alfred A. Knopf, a book publisher. I had absolutely no idea what I was about to become part of, and I was incredibly lucky. Soon, it had occurred to me what my job was. My job was to ask this question.
That question? What do stories look like?
Because that is what Knopf is. It is the story factory, one of the very best in the world. We bring stories to the public. The stories can be anything, and some of them are actually true, but they all have one thing in common. They all need to look like something. They all need a face. Why? To give you a first impression of what you are about to get into.
Do you judge books by their cover?
No, I judge covers by their covers.
Oh, right.
No, seriously, I judge the cover by its cover. And then, you know, going back to the apple thing, you know, okay, so you have an apple, but then all of a sudden you write the word orange underneath it. Well, that's, I don't understand what that means, but it seems to mean something. Now you've got my interest.
Chip Kidd. He's designed some of the most iconic book covers of the past 20 years. You can see them or watch his full talk at ted.npr.org. So if first impressions are critical, in the way Chip Kidd describes, critical to sketching out a story even before you open it, what happens if that impression is wrong, if the story you believe isn't the whole story?
Hello.
This is the novelist Chimamanda Adichie.
Do you want me to keep talking?
Yes, please.
I pledge to Nigeria, my country, to be faithful, loyal, and honest.
Chimamanda was born in Nigeria. She's written several short stories and novels, and I actually talked to her on the day her newest novel, Americana, came out.
What do you do when you first, like, get your book? Like, you see it bound, you know, typeset in a book form?
I just like holding it and just looking at it, you know, sort of looking at the pages and thinking, it's finally a book.
Chimamanda's TED Talk is about what she calls the danger of the single story. And it's an idea that's been with her ever since she started writing.
So I grew up in a small university town in Nigeria and started reading quite early. And I read a lot of British children's books, which was not unusual. This was the norm for children like me. And so when I started to write, I was writing exactly those stories.
All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow, they ate apples, and they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria, I had never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow, we ate mangoes, and we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. My characters also drank a lot of ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have a desperate desire to taste ginger beer.
But I'm assuming you've tried ginger beer since then.
I have. I was terribly disappointed.
What this demonstrates, I think, is how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. Because all I had read were books in which characters were foreign, I had become convinced that books, by their very nature, had to have foreigners in them and had to be about things with which I could not personally identify.
At some point, you realize that storytelling and the stories that you knew, they're not just about these magical or fictional or amazing places, but they actually define the way you think about real things.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a child, I, you know, loving all those British books, I started to read African literature when I think I was maybe 10. And it had such a deep impression on me because I finally was reading about people who seemed more familiar.
I realized that people like me, girls with skin the color of chocolate, whose kinky hair could not form ponytails could also exist in literature. I started to write about things I recognized. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this. It saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this. She had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity.
So the people you met at that time, I mean, they had a single story.
Initially, I was amused by it, and then I became annoyed by it. Just having to constantly deal with people's surprise. You know, and I think what's dangerous about thinking that it's only one thing is that it just limits one's ability to understand or engage or connect. So my roommates, for example, just didn't know what to do with me because in their imagination, an African was only one thing. And then I turn out not to be that thing. And so they would actually often say to me, "You're not really African." I started to think about it quite a bit and I realized, you know what? This is how powerful storytelling can be. So when I came to the US, because I had read a lot of American books and I had watched American films and I listened to American music, I didn't really know America, really, but at least I did know that there were different Americas. At least I had two examples. I knew America could either be Bill Cosby or it could be Dallas. So at least there were two options, right?
Both decent options in some ways.
There you go.
Dallas a little dysfunctional.
So after I had spent some years in the U.S. as an African, I began to understand my roommate's response to me. If I had not grown up in Nigeria, and if all I knew about Africa were from popular images, I too would think that Africa was a place of beautiful landscapes, beautiful animals, and incomprehensible people fighting senseless wars, dying of poverty and AIDS, unable to speak for themselves, and waiting to be saved by a kind white foreigner. This single story of Africa ultimately comes, I think, from Western literature. Now here's a quote from the writing of a London merchant called John Locke, who sailed to West Africa in 1561 and kept a fascinating account of his voyage. After referring to the black Africans as beasts who have no houses, he writes, "They are also people without heads, having their mouths and eyes in their breasts." Now, I've laughed every time I've read this, and one must admire the imagination of John Locke. But what is important about his writing is that it represents the beginning of a tradition of telling African stories in the West, a tradition of sub-Saharan Africa as a place of negatives, of difference, of darkness, of people who, in the words of the wonderful poet Rudyard Kipling, are half-devil, half-child. And so I began to realize that my American roommate must have, throughout her life, seen and heard different versions of this single story.
How do you frame your own story? I mean, you or any of us, how do we sort of own our own stories?
I don't know that we do. I suppose one can try. I constantly actually have to remind myself that if I want to understand a place or thing, that it can't be just one thing. You can't know one thing about a person or place and think that that's it. So I think it's normal, I suppose, maybe human, to make assumptions and to depend on just one single thing.
Why do you think we're so drawn to stories?
Oh, because stories are how we make meaning of our lives. I mean, something happens to me sometimes, and later in recounting it, just in telling the story of what happened to me, there's a kind of meaning that comes. I mean, I think stories are necessary, just as necessary as food and love. It's how we make meaning of our lives.
Stories matter. Many stories matter. Stories have been used to dispossess and to malign. But stories can also be used to empower and to humanize. Stories can break the dignity of a people, but stories can also repair that broken dignity. The American writer Alice Walker wrote this about her Southern relatives who had moved to the North, and she introduced them to a book about the Southern life that they had left behind. They sat around reading the book themselves, listening to me read the book, and the kind of paradise was regained. I would like to end with this thought, that when we reject the single story, when we realize that there is never a single story about any place, we regain a kind of paradise. Thank you.
Novelist Chimamanda Adichie on the TED stage. Her latest novel is called Americana. You can hear her entire talk at ted.npr.org. On the show today, Framing the Story. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, Andrew, it's Guy Raz here.
Hi, Guy. How are you?
I'm just like, can I like test you for a sec?
Sure.
I say, Lawrence, you are a clown.
I don't want to be part of your big push.
It's a great movie, isn't it?
I've definitely seen that movie more than any other movie that I have not worked on.
That's Andrew Stanton again, the filmmaker who we heard from at the beginning of the show, the guy behind Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. and WALL-E. And when we reached him, he was right in the middle of working on the sequel to his film, Finding Nemo.
I am now considered one of the old-timers at Pixar. I've been a writer and animator and director and story man all at different times for the last 23 years.
And as you might be able to tell, Lawrence of Arabia is one of his favorite films of all time. One of mine, too. And School of Rock. I love School of Rock, too.
Put the two right together.
Two
wow,
of my all-time.
Wow, that's a weird double feature.
Anyway, Andrew's TED Talk is about a journey, his own journey, and the way he figured out how to tell a story.
The children's television host, Mr. Rogers, always carried in his wallet a quote from a social worker that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." And the way I like to interpret that is probably the most greatest story commandment, which is, make me care. Please, emotionally, intellectually, aesthetically, just make me care. We all know what it's like to not care. You've gone through hundreds of TV channels just switching.
Yesterday you say their marriage is a
switching.
lovely Shane has
switching
with a great taste that won't fill you up and never let you
switching
for the one day my grandma does
channel after channel
in a neighborhood with you, so let's make the most of this beautiful day.
And then suddenly you actually stop on one.
We might as well say
it's already halfway over, but something's caught you and you're drawn in and you care. That's not by chance, that's by design. So it got me thinking, what if I told you my history was story? How I was born for it. How I learned along the way this subject matter. And so if I were going to give you the ending of this story, it would go something like this. And that's what ultimately led me to speaking to you here at TED about story.
Do you think that you're a natural storyteller?
I think I would say yeah. That's just always been. I'm the oldest of my siblings, and I can't remember a time that I wasn't trying to entertain them. And it's funny. I think that's come organically. My father is a chemical engineer by trade, and so he's very mathematical in his thinking. And his biggest asset is he's a problem solver. And my mother is very artistic. She's a singer and an actress, and the two combined started, now that I look back, make a lot of sense. It's like my desire to entertain, but my desire to understand how it's working, I think come from both parents.
In our earliest days at Pixar, before we truly understood the invisible workings of story, we were simply a group of guys just going on our gut, going on our instincts. And it's interesting to see how that led us places that were actually pretty good. You gotta remember that in this time, 1993, what was considered a successful animated picture was Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. So when we pitched Toy Story to Tom Hanks for the first time, he walked in and he said, "You don't want me to sing, do you?" And I thought that epitomized perfectly what everybody thought animation had to be at the time. But we really wanted to prove that you could tell stories completely different in animation. So we didn't have any influence then, so we had a little secret list of rules that we kept to ourselves, and they were no songs, no I want moment, no happy village, no love story. And the irony is that in the first year, our story was not working at all, and Disney was panicking. So they privately got advice from a famous lyricist who I won't name, and he faxed them some suggestions, and we got a hold of that fax. And the fact said there should be songs, there should be an I Want song, there should be a Happy Village song, there should be a love story, and there should be a villain. And thank goodness we were just too young, rebellious, and contrarian at the time. That just gave us more determination to prove that you could build a better story. And a year after that, we did conquer it. And it just went to prove that storytelling has guidelines, not hard, fast rules. Another fundamental thing we learned was about liking your main character. And we had naively thought, well, Woody in Toy Story has to become selfless at the end, so you got to start from someplace, so let's make him selfish, and this is what you get.
What do you think you're doing? Off the bed. Hey! Off the bed!
You're gonna make. And I guess I should just mention that this clip that you play,
Slinky.
I mean, this is a rough cut.
Slinky!
Of an early version of the film, and Woody is like this unlikable character.
Are you deaf? I said take care of them!
Yeah.
Sorry, Woody, but...
And,
am I hearing correctly?
That was a huge epiphany, was discovering, it wasn't over a night, it wasn't over one meeting, it was over a year and a half. You can make somebody that has all the best of intentions, is actually very likable in almost every scenario, but let's start a story where that kind of person is put in that one scenario that shows their flaw.
Woody, what are you doing under the bed?
Nothing. I'm sure Andy was just a little excited, that's all. Too much cake and ice cream, I suppose. It's just a mistake.
Well, that mistake is sitting in your spot, Woody.
Which told me that everybody is wired conditionally. In other words,
this is my spot, see? The bed here.
Local law.
I mean, everybody has a condition wired up somewhere inside them. They just, sometimes we just don't know what it is.
They'll see. I'm still Andy's favorite toy.
In 1998, I had finished writing Toy Story and A Bug's Life, and I was completely hooked on screenwriting. So I wanted to become much better at it and learn anything I could. So I researched everything I possibly could, and I finally came across this fantastic quote by a British playwright, William Archer. Drama is anticipation mingled with uncertainty. It's an incredibly insightful definition. When you're telling a story, have you constructed anticipation? In the short term, have you made me want to know what will happen next? But more importantly, have you made me want to know how it will all conclude in the long term? Have you constructed honest conflicts with truth that creates doubt in what the outcome might be?
Can you talk about how you did that in WALL-E? Because, I mean, for the first half, there's like almost no dialogue in that movie.
Right. And we watched for months pretty much everything that Buster Keaton ever did and anything Charlie Chaplin ever did.
Wow, really? You watched all these silent films?
All of them. Yeah, and we were already pretty much aficionados, but I wanted to make sure everybody on the crew was. And the thing that you walk away with is that there was nothing they couldn't tell. They were actually better storytellers. People got lazy when sound came in. But the big thing that was an epiphany to me was when you take out dialogue, all your senses are now relying even more on when the music's cues come in, what the lighting's doing. And you have to be that much more finely tuned. You can't be reckless with the other elements. It was like walking a tightrope.
Wow. That's amazing how you prepared for that.
Yeah, it was fun.
Can you describe like a specific scene in that film that is sort of to you like that one of those examples of storytelling?
Well, I'm a sucker for Love at First Sight. I'm a sucker for unrequited love movies and stories. And I just loved, again, it's the punchline for the joke. I knew I wanted to lead up to this moment where you were going to show how much he was not only in love with Eve, but wanted to do something about it. You know, that moment that's pins and needles for anybody in life, like I'm going to ask them to dance or I'm going to actually tell them how I feel. And you're like, okay, I'm never going to hear this guy talk. I'm never going to have him be able to say these words. But I did get to see him see her for the very first time the minute she arrived on the planet. I did see him watch Hello, Dolly. And there was something about it that he was attracted to and he couldn't help but memorize the dance steps. He did like collecting things. And so it was all in the design to make it all come together in this moment where he's showing her his world around his truck. And he's put in the tape, it's playing in the background, Hello Dolly's playing in the background, and she's starting to look at all the material in his truck. She comes across this one lighter. We thought, wouldn't it be fascinating that he's never knew that you could light the lighters. And it just does this huge, powerful thing of making it completely electric, and everybody, the two characters and the audience, are all focused on this light. And you've got his hopes and desires of the world being some funner place, playing in the ambiance of the background. And he's seen in that movie hands hold, so that's the only thing that he associates with that feeling, is seeing these two lovers hold hands. And so you've kind of teed up the audience with all these ingredients so that you pretty much are in WALL-E's head right at that moment before he ever does it. And that's, to me, the most satisfying place to be when you're watching any movie is to be that much in the head of the character at a moment.
Storytelling without dialogue, it's the purest form of cinematic storytelling. It's the most inclusive approach you can take. It confirms something I really had a hunch on, is that the audience actually wants to work for their meal. They just don't want to know that they're doing that. That's your job as a storyteller, is to hide the fact that you're making them work for their meal. We're born problem solvers. We're compelled to deduce and to deduct, because that's what we do in real life. It's this well-organized absence of information that draws us in. There's a reason that we're all attracted to an infant or a puppy. It's not just that they're damn cute. It's because they can't completely express what they're thinking and what their intentions are. And it's like a magnet. We can't stop ourselves from wanting to complete the sentence and fill it in. When I was 5, I was introduced to possibly the most major ingredient that I feel a story should have, but is rarely invoked. And this is what my mother took me to when I was 5.
Some fun, huh, Bambi? Come on, get up, like this.
I walked out of there wide-eyed with wonder. And that's what I think the magic ingredient is, the secret sauce, is can you invoke wonder? Wonder is honest, it's completely innocent, it can't be artificially evoked. For me, there's no greater ability than the gift of another human being giving you that feeling. To hold them still just for a brief moment in their day and have them surrender to wonder. And when an artist does that to another artist, it's like you're compelled to pass it on. It's like a dormant command that's suddenly activated in you, like a call to Devil's Tower. Do unto others what's been done to you. The best stories infuse wonder.
And that sense of wonder slash life-affirming is such a drug. And I don't know how to get it any other way. Maybe some really great pieces of music do it every once in a while. But it's just something that if I can make anybody feel like that for a moment, let alone a whole film, then I can't think of a greater gift.
But there's so many stories out there around us. I mean, you have thousands of choices and options. And
yeah.
I mean, you can watch like a whole series in a weekend.
Binge viewing, yeah.
Yeah. I just saw a Portlandia sketch on that, actually.
I know, the Battlestar Galactica.
You saw that?
It's hilarious. And it's so true. That's why it's so funny.
I mean, but do you think like all those stories all over the place, all the time, I mean, does it make it harder to tell a good story?
It's more crowded, but I think that great storytelling is still rare. I don't think that the averages of home runs have increased that much more for that much more content coming into the world. So it still makes it special. And I think when you see something good, I don't think there's a limited appetite for great stuff. I think your appetite is as insatiable as it needs to be.
When I was 4 years old, I have a vivid memory of finding 2 pinpoint scars on my ankle and asking my dad what they were, and he said I had a matching pair like that on my head, but I couldn't see them because of my hair. And he explained that when I was born premature, that I came out much too early. I was very, very sick, and that when the doctor took a look at this yellow kid with black teeth, he looked straight at my mom and said, he's not going to live. And I was in the hospital for months, and many blood transfusions later, I lived. And that made me special. I don't know if I really believed that. I don't know if my parents really believed that, but I didn't want to prove them wrong. Whatever I ended up being good at, I would strive to be worthy of the second chance I was given.
Daddy's got you. I promise I will never let anything happen to you, Nemo.
And that's the first story lesson I ever learned. Use what you know, draw from it. It doesn't always mean plot or fact. It means capturing a truth from your experiencing, expressing values you personally feel deep down in your core. And that's what ultimately led me to speaking to you here at TED today. Thank you.
Writer and director Andrew Stanton. He's now at work on a sequel to Finding Nemo. It's due out in November of 2015. When people absorb one of your stories, like see one of your films, what do you want them to feel when they leave?
The best compliment is that I forgot where I was, that time went away, and that the light suddenly came up, and I was just so engrossed in that world and that character's issues that I just wish I could go straight back and start watching it all over again. And to me, everything else is a servant of trying to achieve that goal.
There's something almost genius about that opening, Once Upon a Time.
Yes, yes. It's like a spotlight in the dark. It's saying, this is worth your attention, and it's so worth your attention that nobody's forgotten it.
Out there, there's a world outside of Yonkers. Way out there beyond this hick town, Barnaby. There's a slick town, Barnaby. Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
In one of those new horse-drawn open cars, we'll see the shows at Delmonico's, and we'll close the town in a whirl.